Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally, 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries worldwide daily over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Supreme Court when we come back. The genocidal policy of Global 2000 and this New World Order are the greatest threats to our lives, our liberties, and our property since Noah's flood. And that's not just my opinion. Jesus of Nazareth held that same view when he said in Matthew 24, verse 22, that except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved alive. Now, there are 64 life-threatening problems described in Scripture detailing this New World Order and their global 2000 genocide plan. And the Scripture teaches preparation for that great tribulation, not just apathy and indifference. That's why I contend that it's time that you and I wise up and start listening more to the God of Israel and stop following after all these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians like Ted Kennedy or Arlen Specter or Hillary. Let's prepare to live through and survive this global 2000 New World Order nightmare. And to do just that, why don't you call, write, or email the law school and ask for that 64 life-threatening problems from the Scripture. And let's talk about formulating a real, meaningful, intelligent plan to survive global 2000 and the other 64 life-threatening problems that are called the Great Tribulation in Scripture. Just call and order our free general law CD package. That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, our subsistence and survival school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget. All right, last time we're talking about the Supreme Court and this process or this concept, which is called judicial review versus strict interpretation. Thomas Jefferson's view, if you'll remember, was that the judicial review system was flawed. He was opposed to it. He said that the final arbitrating power should be in the branches of government themselves, which are separated and defined and subject to the vote of the people. And if there's some conflict that the people don't like, they can vote those officers out. But you can't vote a judge out. The other side of the argument was made by Justice Marshall, who was Thomas Jefferson's cousin. And he said, no, my experience in the legislature and the corruption that I see there and the politics that I see requires judicial review so that there's a final decision on these questions that are raised from time to time concerning laws and procedures. Now, the thing came to a head at the end of the Civil War with the enactment of the Reconstruction statutes, and particularly the 14th Amendment, and I commented on the Supreme Court of Utah. I think it was in the Gary Gilmore case. They wrote a treatise, and they said, now listen, this 14th Amendment over here is a pile of garbage, and it interrupts the separation of powers doctrine between the departments of government. That is, it places the federal government in a dominant position over the states, and so we commented about that. And that's exactly where you're at today. And power is centralized in Washington, D.C., whether we like it or not. That's the way the game is being played. Now, let's take a look at the personal qualifications of judges. What personal qualifications should be required for a justice of the Supreme Court? Well, another weakness in the judicial structure of the Supreme Court is the fact that appointments to the Supreme Court are often dominated by political considerations rather than the judicial competency of the nominee. This became rather shockingly apparent during the heyday of the Warren Court, when that court became so highly controversial because of its frequent reversals of former Supreme Court decisions and its propensity for smashing traditional constitutional barriers. In 1961, Senator Eastland of Mississippi pointed out that the Senate must take responsibility for having affirmed the appointments of an entire body of justices, not one of whom had any substantive experience as a judge prior to being appointed to the Supreme Court. From Chief Justice Earl Warren down to the last justice to ascend to the bench, not one had qualified himself with any judicial experience. And it will be recalled that the Constitution provided a standard of qualifications for congressmen, senators, and the president, but nothing is said about the qualifications required for members of the Supreme Court. So there was and is a need for corrective measures when abuses occur. And all of the above considerations bring us to the brief discussion of the responsibility weighing upon the American people to rectify a number of serious breaches in constitutional principles involving the federal judiciary. To appreciate how far we have strayed, let us examine the words of a notable constitutional authority, Edwin S. Corwin, who wrote the Constitution of the United States Annotated, an official government publication. He points out that the Supreme Court has passed through four identifiable stages of development, which may be summarized as follows. Here are those four stages. The first was when John Marshall, and in the John Marshall period, when the Constitution was used to establish national supremacy. The Federalist Papers and the words of the founders were almost the exclusive guide to constitutional interpretations during that first period. The second period began with the appointment of Chief Justice Taney in 1835 and extended to approximately 1895. During this period of history, the Supreme Court leaned heavily on various doctrines of constitutional theory and seldom quoted the Founders or the Federalist Papers. Nevertheless, the Court adhered rather strictly to the philosophy of the Founders, even though they seldom quoted the Founders. And the third period, beginning around 1895, the Supreme Court moved into a third phase by gradually replacing constitutional supremacy with judicial supremacy. The Constitution was no longer what the founders said it was, but rather what the Supreme Court said it was. And to quote Dr. Corwin, quote, he said, "It was early in this period that Governor Charles Evans Hughes, soon to ascend the bench and later serve as Chief Justice from 1930 to 1941, said without perhaps intending all that his words literally conveyed. But he said, we're under a constitution, but the constitution is what the judges say it is. Now, Senator Borah, in the Senate debate on Mr. Hughes' nomination for Chief Justice in 1930, declared that the Supreme Court had become economic dictator in the United States. And some of the justices concurred in these observations, especially Justice Holmes and Brandeis. As asserted the latter, the court had made itself a super legislature, and Justice Holmes could discover hardly any limit but the sky to the power claimed by the court to disallow state acts, which may happen to strike a majority of its members as for any reason undesirable. And then fourth, the final period is one which is continuing today. It is the spectacle of a judiciary virtually out of control and seriously in need of repair by a constitutional amendment. As Edwin Corwin writes, what was once vaunted as a constitution of rights, both state rights and private rights, has now been replaced to a great extent by a constitution of powers. The federal system has shifted base in the direction of a consolidated national power. Within the national government itself, there has been an increased flow of power in the direction of the president. Even judicial enforcement of the Bill of Rights has faltered at times in the presence of national emergency. So there is now time for a constitutional amendment, and the founders anticipated the possibility that the branches of the federal government would warp their channels of authority. And Alexander Hamilton urged future generations to take action whenever this occurred. Hamilton said that if the federal government should overpass the just bounds of its authority and make a tyrannical use of its powers, the people, whose creature it is, must appeal to the standard that they have formed, the Constitution, and take such measures to redress the injury to the Constitution as the exigency may suggest and prudence justify. Well, Thomas Jefferson also suggested an amendment to the Constitution so that either Congress or the state legislature, or both, might have a veto power or removal power over the Supreme Court, and thereby provide the people with a remedy when the court strayed from the Constitution. And Jefferson wrote, quote, "There was another amendment of which none of us thought at the time when the Constitution was framed, and in the omission of which lurks the germ that is to destroy this happy combination of national powers in the general government. For matters of national concern and independent powers in the states, for what concerns the states severally, I deem it indispensable to the continuance of this government that they, the opinions of the Supreme Court, should be submitted to some practical and impartial control, and this, to be impartial, must be compounded of a mixture of state and federal authorities. I do not charge the judges with willful and ill-intentioned error, but honest error must be arrested where its toleration leads to public ruin." So let's take a quick look inside the U.S. Supreme Court today. And let us now take a brief look at the internal operations of the nation's highest judicial organ, the Supreme Court of the United States. The work assignment of the 9 justices who serve on the Supreme Court is scheduled on the basis of 2 biweekly intervals. For the first interval of 2 weeks, the court listens to oral arguments, makes rulings on motions, and announces decisions on cases. The court then recesses for 2 weeks while the justices cloister themselves in their private office suites. There, they work with a cadre of law clerks chosen from among the top students of the nation's foremost law schools, reviewing, pondering, and evaluating the numerous petitions assigned to each justice for review, or writing opinions in cases already adjudicated. These alternating biweekly work patterns continue throughout the term of the court from October to late June. Each Wednesday or Friday, the justices meet in a secret conference to perform one of their most important functions, and that is deciding which cases will be accepted for review. The conference chamber is located next to the office of the Chief Justice, and the associate justices are assembled by a special buzzer. There must be a quorum of six or more to do business. As they enter the room, the justices follow a ritual, initiated in 1888, of formally greeting and shaking hands with each other. No doubt, this helps to soften the memory of vigorous polemics in former meetings and to ameliorate the occasional hostilities which erupt during the decision-making process on important cases. Clerks wheel in cartloads of law books to be used during the conference and then retire to leave the justices alone. As the conference opens, the Chief Justice begins the discussion, followed by another justice in order of seniority. The agenda includes only those cases which one or more of the justices has submitted for consideration, and at least four votes must be in favor of a case to get it accepted for review. Now, after this conference, the parties to each case which has been approved for review are then asked to submit briefs, 40 copies each. Sometimes their attorneys will be asked to appear before the full court and argue the case orally. This is a rare privilege, and only 5% of the cases receive this honor. The hearings are held in a somewhat awesome precincts of the vaulted ceilings of the courtroom, and the court takes itself seriously, and some of the proceedings are still cloaked in the ceremonial pomp which has been traditional since the court's first session in New York City in 1790. Some of the lawyers, especially those representing the Solicitor General's office in the Department of Justice, appear before the court in formal striped trousers and tailcoats. On the counsel tables of the lawyers are crossed goose quill pens. Each of the justices is still furnished with a highly polished brass spittoon, used these days merely as a wastebasket. The Chief Justice sits in the center of the high bench with the Senior Justice at his right, the next in seniority to his left, and so forth. The lawyers make their arguments from a lectern or directly in front of the high bench or platform where the justices are seated. Each side is usually limited to half an hour to present its arguments, but a full hour is permitted in the more critical cases. The briefs of the attorneys will have been studied beforehand by all of the justices, so that the attorneys on each side are then subjected to many questions from the bench. Each lawyer must watch the lights on the lectern, which warn him as to how much time he has left. A white light indicates there are 5 minutes remaining, and a red light flashes to indicate that the presentation must end. Now, after the oral argument, the justices hand in their votes. At least 5 votes are needed for a party to win. If there is a vacancy or an abstention, so that the vote is a tie, say 4-4, the lower court's ruling then stands. But the case does not become a binding precedent to govern similar cases in the future in the federal and state courts throughout the nation. This means that the issue raised by that case is still open-ended. And even though it has been settled with finality for those particular parties, once the votes are handed in, a justice must be assigned to write the official opinion. The Chief Justice will make the assignment personally if he is one of the majority. But if he does not agree with the decision in a particular case, then the Senior Justice on the majority side will make the assignment, After a draft of the opinion is completed, copies are printed under the strictest security in the court's own print shop and then circulated among the justices. Suggestions are made and a final draft is agreed upon. The dissenters may wish to choose one of their members to present the reasons for their dissent. Justices may also write their own concurring or their own dissenting opinions if the views of the others do not coincide with what they feel should be said. And it's always a dramatic moment when the court announces from the bench its decision in a particular case. Such announcements are always made without any advance notice. From that moment on, the legal ruling laid down by the court in that particular case becomes the supreme law of the land whenever that same issue arises in the future. This is sometimes referred to as the doctrine of stare decisis. So when you're watching the Senate confirming a new appointee to the court, they'll often ask questions, and they want to know about the judge's view on Roe versus Wade and abortion and a number of other subject matters. Well, what they're looking for is the politics of the candidate. Is this guy a liberal or a conservative? Now, there was a time when judges were thought of as being non-political. That doesn't happen anymore. Our court is politicized, as is our society. Everybody in society is politicized. And, of course, the court then resembles the view of the president who's going to make the nomination. Now, President Obama the other day was making a comment, and he said that the man that he selects, he wants to be able to identify and have empathy for the people. Well, in strict construction, the law is the law is the law. There's only one justice on the Supreme Court that I know of that believes in strict construction, and that's Justice Scalia. And in his view and his construction, his politics, his personal druthers are subordinate to the document itself. The plain construction of the document says that this is what we've got to do, whether I agree with it or not. We have strict construction and we have liberal interpretation of the Bible. Works the same way. Let's give you an illustration. The strict construction of the Bible is that all Scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, reproof, correction, and instruction. A liberal interpretation is, no, that's not true. That the Bible is open to interpretation, and our interpretation is thus and such. Well, we have the same thing here with the Constitution of the United States. The plain words of the Second Amendment, you know, that the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. If we were to take a look at the writings of the day and the plain intent of the words that are being employed, and then we take a look at 25,000 regulations concerning firearms in the United States, we have a liberal interpretation of the Second Amendment. Although the court split 5-4 on a strict construction of the Second Amendment when they determined last year, it was in 2008, that the Second Amendment was an individual right. And under strict interpretation, that was a no-brainer, but when you're looking at liberal construction, well then, you know, that was a milestone decision. Now, there are some areas of the Constitution, or some areas of life, like abortion and reproductive rights and Roe versus Wade, that didn't really have any place in the Supreme Court to start with. It was outside the scope of the Constitution. It's like the income tax, and the court made this observation in Schaefer versus Carter. and that was that the income tax is not constitutional, and the income tax is not unconstitutional. The income tax is contractual. And that's where reality is. But, you know, we have interpretations of, well, here's what we think that means. Now, in the Scripture, we are strictly prohibited from any private interpretation of the Scripture. If you go to Deuteronomy 4, verse 2, and Deuteronomy 12, verse 32, it tells you plainly that the Scripture is of no private interpretation. And then it says, you shall not add to this word which I command you this day, and you shall not detract from it. Now, that's called strict construction. Now, of course, we don't follow that. We're busily trying to correct all of God's mistakes, and we're busy running around doing that. Now, this thing of limits to judicial review has some merit to it. Whether or not it could function literally as Thomas Jefferson had envisioned it to work, with the checks and balances being held in the state legislatures at the state level, that's another question. It didn't work because of the Reconstruction Amendments that were added to the Constitution after the Civil War. There was a great debate that came up in the country concerning slavery. The Founding Fathers were not opposed to slavery. If they had been opposed to slavery, they would have abolished it with the Constitution. The Bible does not abolish slavery. Slavery was established by the Creator Himself, as was bond servitude. These are social stations or social strata in life. We use that to this day. We call it status in law today. And there are 16 statuses of persons in law today recognized in the judicial procedures. And, you know, as an individual, for instance, in Hale versus Henkel, there's an individual mentioned. Well, he has the highest status. And then there's a status of a convict. He has the lowest status. And there are things in between, like corporations and agents and officers and two-thirds of the people, and, you know, and so on. The Constitution talks about, and our judicial policies and statutes and laws talk about these various statuses of persons. A married woman has a status in society different from a single woman or a man. And as an illustration of that, women cannot be drafted into the army, but men can. Women have a higher status than men. Just as a matter of law, that's the way it is. It's not that way because I'm telling you it is. That's the way it is. Women cannot be drafted into the army, and men can. Is that fair? I don't know. I don't make these laws. I don't make these rules. I didn't have any input into the Ten Commandments. And then I have a little bit of input, but darn little, into the laws of the United States or the judgments that come out of it. Now, occasionally, you can go into court and you can bring up an issue, and then that issue will be decided. Maybe you're on the winning side. And by bringing up that issue, you might have some input into the public policy. But as a general rule, most of us as individuals don't have much input. Now, these judges do. And the debate here, should there be limits to this thing of judicial review? Should there be limits on it? Now, the people who write the treatise here, and so I'm not here to tell you how you should form your opinions. I'm a reporter. And the opinions that are being espoused here by W. Cleon Skousen and James R. Patrick and Thomas Jefferson and, you know, and others, Judge Spencer Roan, the Indianapolis Star, for example, These are opinions that are meant by the proponents of them to advance the debate, you know, to give you some education, some input and information so that you can make a decision. Well, what do you think? And this is put out. This is called Foundations of Liberty, and it's the title of the booklet. It's put out twice a month. It's called Foundations of Liberty. It's an educational format. This one is entitled The Supreme Court. If you'd like to get a copy of it, why don't you write to the publisher? It's called the East Moline Christian School. Moline is spelled M-O-L-I-N-E, East Moline Christian School. It's in Moline, Illinois. And then there's a town, evidently, or a subdivision here called East Moline, Illinois. They're located at 946th Avenue in East Moline, Illinois, 61244. And they have a phone that's 309-796-1485. And the phone number again, 309-796-1485. And it's James R. Patrick who is the editor. Foundations of Liberty is published bimonthly by the East Moline Christian School. The East Moline Christian School believes and teaches the fundamental truths of the Bible, as well as offering a total academic program for grades K through 12. We firmly believe in the principles that gave birth to America. Therefore, we teach without apology the concepts of biblical law, limited constitutional government, the right of private property, and the free market economic system. The cost of this publication is met through donations. Donations are encouraged and appreciated in any amount. And may we suggest $25 a year per person on the mailing list, and sample copies to the Foundations of Liberty are available to any interested person in the United States upon request, and bulk prices are available if shipped to one address. So if you'd like a copy of this publication called The Supreme Court, put out by Foundations of Liberty, if you'd write and ask for this article on the Supreme Court, I'm sure that they will send you a copy. All right, now let me give you a mid-course reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now it's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to these authors and publications that we use on this program. and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that those authors or publications that we're endorsing will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing the booklet from Foundations of Liberty, which is entitled The Supreme Court. Now, Thomas Jefferson had an observation that he wrote to Judge Spencer Roane on September the 6th, 1819. Now, remember, there's two views that are being espoused here. Jefferson's view that judicial review was a dangerous doctrine. Judicial review is what we use today in America. He said that it would concentrate power in the Supreme Court in Washington, D.C., and usurp the power of the states. Jefferson was exactly correct. That's exactly what's happened. Now, is that all bad, or is that partly good and partly bad, or is it all good? Because John Marshall was the champion of judicial review. He disagreed with Jefferson. And his judicial review doctrine has indeed become the law of the land. It's the way we do business here. I'm not here taking a side one way or the other. I'm a reporter, and I'm reporting these two views. Well, Jefferson started off with a letter to Judge Spencer Roane, and he said, "I had read in the Inquirer, and with great approbation, the pieces signed Hamden, and have read them again with redoubled approbation. In the copies you have been so kind to send to me, I subscribe to every tittle of them. They contain the true principles of the Revolution of 1800, for that was as real a revolution in the principles of our government as that of 1776 was in its form. Not affected indeed by the sword, as that, but by the rational and peaceable instrument of reform, the suffrage of the people. The nation declared its will by dismissing functionaries of one principle and electing those of another in the two branches, executive and legislative, submitted to their election. Over the judiciary department, the Constitution had deprived them of their control. That, therefore, has continued the reprobated system, and although new matters has been occasionally incorporated into the old, yet the leaven of the old mass seems to assimilate to itself the new. And after 20 years' confirmation of the federal system by the voice of the nation, declared through the medium of the elections, we find the judiciary on every occasion still driving us into consolidation. In denying the right they usurp of exclusively explaining the Constitution, and I go further than you do, if I understand rightly your quotation from the Federalist, of an opinion that the judiciary is the last resort in relation to the other departments of the government, but not in relation to the rights of the parties to the compact under which the judiciary is derived. If this opinion be sound, then indeed is our Constitution a complete fellow de se, for intending to establish three departments, coordinate and independent, that they might check and balance one another, it has given, according to this opinion, to one of them alone the right to prescribe rules for the government of the other two, and to that one also, which is unelected by an independent of the nation, for the judges are appointed for life. For experience has already shown that the impeachment that it has provided is not even a scarecrow, that such opinions as to the one you combat sent cautiously out, as you observed also, by detachment, not belonging to the case often, but sought for out of it, as if to rally the public opinion beforehand to their views, and to indicate the line that they are to walk in, have been so quietly passed over as never to have excited adamant aversion even in a speech of any one of the body entrusted with impeachment. Now, the Constitution on this hypothesis is a mere thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary, which they may twist and shape into any form that they please. And it should be remembered as an axiom of eternal truth in politics that whatever power in any government is independent is absolute also. In theory only at first, while the spirit of the people is up, but in practice as fast as that relaxes. Independence can be trusted nowhere but with the people in mass. They are inherently independent of all but moral law. My construction of the Constitution is very different from that you quote. It is that each department is truly independent of the others and has an equal right to decide for itself what is the meaning of the Constitution in the cases submitted to its action, and especially where it is to act ultimately and without appeal. I will explain myself by examples which, having occurred while I was in office, are better known to me and the principles which governed them. A legislature had passed the sedition law. The federal courts had subjected certain individuals to its penalties of fine and imprisonment. On coming into office, I released these individuals by the power of pardon, committed to executive discretion, which could never be more properly exercised than where citizens were suffering without the authority of law, or which was equivalent under a law unauthorized by the Constitution and therefore null and void. In the case of Marbury and Madison, the federal judges declared that commissions signed and sealed by the president were valid, although not delivered. Well, I deemed delivery essential to complete a deed, which, as long as it remains in the hands of the party, is as yet no deed. It is in posse only, but not in esse. And I withheld delivery of the commissions. They cannot issue a mandamus to the president or legislature or to any of their officers. When the British arrived without any provision against the impressment of our seamen, I determined not to ratify it. The Senate thought that I should ask their advice, and I thought that would be a mockery of them when I was predetermined against following it, should they advise its ratification. The Constitution had made their advice necessary to confirm a treaty, but not to reject it. This has been blamed by some, but I have never doubted its soundness. In the cases of two persons, Antonatti, under exactly similar circumstances, the federal court had determined that one of them, Duane, was not a citizen. The House of Representatives, nevertheless, determined that the other, Smith of South Carolina, was a citizen, and admitted him to his seat in their body. Duane was a Republican, and Smith was a Federalist, and these decisions were made during the federal ascendancy. These are examples of my position, that each of the three departments has equally the right to decide for itself what is its duty under the Constitution, without any regard whatsoever to what the others may have decided for themselves under a similar question. But you intimate a wish that my opinion should be known on this subject. Well, no, dear sir. I withdraw from all contest of my opinion and resign everything cheerfully to the generation which is now in place. They are wiser than we were, and their successors will be wiser indeed than they are from the progressive advance of science. Tranquility is the sum bonum of age, and I wish, therefore, to offend no man's opinion, nor to draw disquieting aversions on my own. And while duty required it, I met opposition with a firm and fearless step. But loving mankind in my individual relations with them, I pray to be permitted to depart in their peace. And like the soldier, to hang my arms on the post, I have unwisely, I fear, embarked in an enterprise of great public concern, but not to be accomplished within my term without their liberal and prompt support. A several illness the last year, and another from which I am just emerged, admonish me that repetitions may be expected, against which a declining frame cannot long bear up. I am anxious, therefore, to get our university so far advanced as may encourage the public to persevere to its final accomplishment. That secured, I shall sing my Dunc Dimittis, and I hope your labors will be long continued in the spirit in which they have always been exercised, in maintenance of those principles on which I verily believe the future happiness of our country essentially depends. And I salute you with affectionate and great respect. Now, that was Thomas Jefferson. Now, Jefferson did not subscribe to this concept of judicial review. That's the point that's being made here. Now, judicial review is the final say on a judicial question. Now, Judge Scalia was being interviewed on 60 Minutes, and he was being interviewed by that woman on that show. I've forgotten her name now, but she questioned the court's interference in the 2000 election. And she said, the election of 2000 was decided by the court in a narrow 5-4 decision. And Scalia said, yep, that's right. And then she questioned that, and she said, well, isn't that the judiciary electing the president? And he said, yep, that's right. And she said, well, is that democratic? And he said, no, it isn't. And she said, well, then shouldn't that be changed, or shouldn't that be challenged? And he said, no, it shouldn't. And so she said, well, why not? And Judge Scalia said, because it was Al Gore who petitioned the court to make the decision. And if he hadn't petitioned the court, we'd have never gotten involved in it, and we wouldn't have decided. It would have been decided by the Florida legislature, or by the Florida Supreme Court, or by some other body. You asked us the question, and we told you the answer. Now you're sitting there saying you don't like what you heard. That's judicial review. Now, where you ask for it, you may not like the answer that you receive. So if you don't want to know the answer, then you better not ask the question. Now, a newspaper called the Indianapolis Star put out a series of articles, and they called it the runaway court. They said that the court is a runaway court. I don't know if it's a runaway court or not. I'll leave that for you to decide. Let me report to you what these various authors have said, and then you decide for yourself which you want to subscribe to. The Indianapolis Star said this: our country was born in revolt against tyranny, a revolt sparked by individual colonial clergymen who preached the theology of freedom, sparked by the resistance of daring men such as those who staged the Boston Tea Party, and then sparked by courageous politicians such as Patrick Henry, who, not knowing what others would do, spoke for himself alone when he said, "Give me liberty or give me death." But our liberty today is in dire jeopardy on many counts, not the least of which is the fast and loose way in which the Supreme Court has been playing with our Constitution, chipping away at the intent of its authors. In the latter part of 1957, the Indianapolis Star published a series of several editorials, which, according to publisher Eugene C. Pulliam, were written after long and careful study of recent court decisions and of the historical relationships between the Supreme Court, the Congress, and the presidency, in order to focus wider public attention on the most critical constitutional issues of our times. And we quote from several of this series. Well, in the first article, called The Runaway Court Number 1, they said that something has gone wrong at the roots of America's government. The three-way balance of constitutional authority is tipping crazily. Alarmed lawmakers have introduced a dozen serious proposals in the Congress to shackle the United States Supreme Court within the limits of the Constitution. The president strongly, though inadvertently, has expressed dissatisfaction with his appointees to the court, governors, bar associations, respected attorneys, even lower courts have shown open dismay at the way the Supreme Court is going. Every forum of free opinion has added its criticism on one court or another. There has never been another such clamor against the high court, which depends as surely as do executive or legislative branches upon the consent of the governed for its authority. The court has been the hub of turmoil many times before, most recently as a result of President Franklin D. Roosevelt's court packing scheme, but always before it has had more friends than detractors in the places where public opinion begins. And today the tide of influence is setting against the court, no matter where the minor cross currents stirred by its separate decisions may run. Now, the court is engaged in a race which, if persisted in, can be won only by destroying the governmental system that we revere. It is competing against time to enforce new doctrines before nebulous public resentment becomes hardened public resistance. It has on its side the diehard popular belief, which is false as a China nest egg, that the law is what the court says it is. In a constitutional crisis such as the court is precipitating, vague generalities cannot continue to win acceptance. The public is already stirring to awareness that the court is not an originator, but an instrument of the law. In this struggle that is shaping up, intelligent decisions can be supported only out of full understanding of the issues. The Star intends to present a series of editorials, of which this is the first, dealing with the causes, the proof and the impact of the court's defection, and with possible defenses against it. At the outset, it should be recalled that the court's position is in our government. No other operation of the federal system is so thoroughly misunderstood. One article had and one amendment to the Constitution relate directly to the Supreme Court. Another article defines the supreme law of the land without mentioning the court at all. And Article 3 provides the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. So let's notice that this judicial power is not regarded by the Constitution as indivisible. It does not say that the power is vested in one Supreme Court to be administered by it through such inferior courts. It says the power belongs to the Supreme Court and the inferior courts. This was not a slip of the pen. The men who wrote the Constitution did not intend the Supreme Court to be, in fact, supreme. They made this undeniably clear when, in the same Article 3, Section 2, they decreed that the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and to fact, with such exception and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. Now, nothing could be clearer. Congress is given the sole right to divide the judicial power between the Supreme Court and the lower courts. All other references in the Constitution to judicial power set up limitations. None grants broader authority. The 11th Amendment forbids the federal judiciary to act in cases brought against one state by a citizen of another state. There are numerous provisions detailing what the courts may not do. They may not, for example, deny trial by jury in criminal prosecutions. And in Article 6, the Constitution comes directly to grips with the question, what is the supreme law of the land? And it says, this Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. No mention at all is made of the Supreme Court. The law is what the Constitution says it is, and what Congress, acting within its constitutional limits, says that it is. No federal court has any legal authority whatsoever to rule out or to alter the law, violates the Constitution. Now, no federal court has any authority or right to change the Constitution by so much as one word, either by interpretation or by subterfuge. To do so is as illegal as armed robbery, and it deserves no more respect. We are, all of us, as morally bound to resist usurpation of power by the Supreme Court or any other court as we are to resist any other violation of the law. That was the Indianapolis Star in their first critique of the Supreme Court. We'll take a look at the runaway court in Section 2 next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Meanwhile, let me remind you that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.